March 5, 2014. I'm Albert Moeller, and this is The Briefing, a daily analysis of news and events from a Christian worldview. The culture of death prefers to move forward by evasion and stealth, rarely baring its teeth, rarely showing its hand. But every once in a while, one of the leaders of the culture of death slips and makes a very candid comment. And when those comments are made, we need to note them very carefully, for they point to one of the great perils of our age. Just recently, one of those comments was made by Cecile Richards, who is the president of the Planned Parenthood Federation of America. She made the comment in a conversation on Fusion TV with host Jose Ramos. Ramos was asking her about her support for abortion, her work with Planned Parenthood, and then he asked her a question he obviously intended for her to answer. He expected for her to answer. He asked her when she believes that human life begins. Before looking further at the exchange between Ramos and Cecile Richards, we need to recognize that the question of when human life begins is one of the most unavoidable of all questions related to the issue of abortion. The answer to that question, in effect, determines one's position on the abortion question. And that's what makes her conversation with Jose Ramos so interesting. Cecile Richards, obviously, did not want to answer this question. She's no stranger to controversy, of course. She is the president of Planned Parenthood. She leads one of the central institutions of the culture of death. Planned Parenthood was born in the dark vision of Margaret Sanger, one of the darkest figures of the 20th century, a woman who was committed to what she called having more babies from the fit and less from the unfit, a progenitor and promoter of eugenics, the idea that people should be encouraged to have children, but only those people from the right families or the right races. This is the part of Planned Parenthood's legacy they hope most people will not remember. But when Cecile Richards heads Planned Parenthood, she is heading an organization that is the nation's most visible promoter and provider of abortion. She's been an ardent defender of what she calls a woman's right to an abortion for her baby at any time for any reason. She also believes not only that a woman should have the right to an abortion without restraint, without question, at any point in the pregnancy and for any reason. She also is on record as stating that she believes that taxpayers should pay the bill for the abortion as well. Her support of abortion for any reason and at any stage of fetal development, including the most barbarous so-called partial birth abortions, was explained in her interview with Jose Ramos. Ramos, you'll recall, asked her when human life begins. Her response, quote, "It's not something I really feel like is really part of this conversation. Every woman needs to make their own decision," end quote. That's an amazing statement. She says that she doesn't really feel like the question of when human life begins is really part of this conversation. That's a bizarre evasion. Her non-answer to one of the most fundamental questions of human dignity was shocking enough. But there was simply more to come. As it turns out, Richards does have a belief about when human life begins. Ramos himself was apparently surprised by her evasion of the question and asked, quote, "Why would it be controversial for you to say when you think life starts?" end quote. She then offered another non-answer, quote, "I don't know that it's controversial. I don't know that it's really relevant to the conversation," end quote. Seriously, Cecile Richards? You don't believe that the question of when human life begins is relevant when the conversation is about abortion? Well, at that point, she couldn't avoid the question any longer, and she dropped her bombshell. Quote, "For me, I'm the mother of three children. For me, life began when I delivered them. They've been probably the most important thing in my life ever since, but that was my own personal decision," end quote. Well, there's one thing we need to note before we look in detail at her answer, and that is this. The question of when human life begins isn't something that every woman is going to decide, or every human being for that matter. It's something that's going to be decided in a way that either affirms human dignity or not. It's not a question that is left to an individual judgment. As a matter of fact, it's one of those issues that can only be fully addressed by those who either say that human dignity attaches to no human being at any point of development, or those who say, with equal principle, that it applies to all human beings at every stage of development. Anything in between those is simply unsustainable and arbitrary. Cecile Richards identified her three children as probably the most important thing in my life, she said, since their delivery. Well, were they nothing at all to her at any point when they were in her womb? She says that life begins at delivery, an amazingly candid statement. So until a baby is delivered, there is no life, no dignity, no sanctity at all. That defies any moral sense. We also need to note, it defies modern biology. Cecile Richards did not try to argue the now infamous trimester argument of Roe v. Wade or a point of viability or any other argument about fetal development. As her comment makes clear, in her worldview, the fetus simply doesn't matter at all. That's one of the saddest, scariest, and most tragic statements I've seen in a very long time. Candid admissions of a worldview like this one are rare, but Cecile Richards' statement perfectly explains her advocacy of abortion at any time for any reason. In her interview, the culture of death bears its teeth. And as it does so, it makes an amazing concession, an amazing admission. The fetus simply doesn't matter at all. Until delivery, there is no life. There is no dignity. There is no sanctity. And that explains, as nothing else can explain, the ardent support of abortion and death in the womb that is in the part of Planned Parenthood and Cecile Richards. And we hear those words, and we now understand why. It was last year that the Boy Scouts of America announced a change, a dramatic change, indeed a radical change, in their membership policy. After holding for years, indeed for decades, to a policy that excluded openly gay scouts, the Boy Scouts reversed course, and their national council last year voted to change that policy as to allow openly gay scouts and yet not to allow openly gay scouting leaders. Now, as we talked about the issue back last year, it became apparent that even the scouts admitted that the vast majority of the parents of scouting believed that there should be the prohibition on openly gay scouts in the Boy Scouts of America. And yet, the Boy Scouts found themselves under enormous cultural, political, and economic pressure. Some of their own board members represented major Fortune 500 corporations that were calling upon the Boy Scouts to make this change or to lose funding. And not only to lose funding, but to lose cultural footing as well. In recent years, the Boy Scouts had defended their policy ardently. They defended it all the way to the United States Supreme Court, where they won a Supreme Court decision that established that the Boy Scouts have a constitutional right to have adhered to their policy. But then they gave it away. And they gave it away in a halfway measure that, as I said last year, would not please anyone. The halfway measure was to accept gay scouts, but not to accept gay scouting leaders. And the scouting organization clearly hoped that this would allow them to dodge the controversy and to find some kind of safe place, a place that would allow them some respite from the national controversy. But that was not to be the case, as the Disney Corporation just recently made very clear. The Disney Corporation has announced that it will no longer allow funding through some of its charitable giving programs to go to the Boy Scouts of America or any of its local units because the Boy Scouts continue to discriminate. According to Disney, it isn't enough that the Boy Scouts decided to allow openly gay scouts. By not allowing for openly gay scouting leaders, they continue to discriminate. As the Associated Press reports, the Boy Scouts organization announced that it was disappointed by the decision, and yet the Walt Disney Company is insisting it will cut funding of the Boy Scouts of America beginning in the year 2015 because of the policy that bans adult gay leaders in the organization. At this point, the Orange County Register enters the conversation. In Tuesday's edition of that paper, which, by the way, is published in the very county where Disneyland is located, the paper made very clear that this is part of a concerted effort by the Disney Corporation to reach out to gays and lesbians. As reporters for the Orange County Register indicated, when Gay Days Anaheim started in 1998 with 2,500 participants in red shirts attending Disneyland, the park would accommodate offended guests by refunding tickets and handing out white T-shirts to those who were unknowingly supporting the Gay Pride Day by showing up wearing red. But that was 1998, and this is 2014. And as the Orange County Register makes very clear, the situation has changed remarkably. The paper quotes Eddie Shapiro, a founder of the unofficial annual get-together for gays at Disney, who said, quote, "They've come to realize that those kinds of accommodations are inappropriate." He's the author, by the way, of a book entitled Queens in the Kingdom, The Ultimate Gay and Lesbian Guide to the Disney Theme Parks. As the newspaper summarizes Disney's new corporate policy, quote, "Over the years, the Walt Disney Company has evolved in its support of the lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender communities." Quote, "That support was punctuated recently when Disney decided to cut off donations beginning next year to the Boy Scouts in a narrowly focused program because the youth organization bans adult gay leaders." They go on to make many other statements explaining how Disney has decided to make a particular outreach to the homosexual community. The paper reports, quote, Disney officials long have offered employee benefits to same-sex partners, began offering fairy tale weddings to same-sex partners for commitment ceremonies in 2007, and last year signed a court brief supporting same-sex marriage. The former head of Disneyland, who is now the head of Disney World, is openly gay. And as the paper makes very clear, Disney is doing everything it can to create bridges to the homosexual community. If you're wondering why the company would take this direction, the question is answered in the newspaper article by Ismail Adibi, a Chapman University economist, who made the point that Disney is clearly willing to lose some business in order to be seen in the larger culture as a progressive corporation. As the paper reports, Disney is just being politically correct, which might cost it some patronage from members of the Boy Scouts while enhancing its image as a progressive company that's open to all, end quote. Of course, the part about this is really interesting and rather revealing are the last words of that paragraph, open to all. But as Disney made very clear, now deciding that it's not going to be funding the Boy Scouts of America, it's not exactly open to all. It's open to all who agree with the company. And the company is very clear about its own beliefs. And that's something that American parents should certainly keep in mind. Now shifting the issue to that of marijuana, in the state of California, Governor Jerry Brown now says that the legalization of recreational marijuana in his state might not be such a good idea. As the Associated Press reports, California Governor Jerry Brown said he is not sure legalizing marijuana is a good idea in the Golden State because the country could lose its competitive edge if too many people are getting stoned. If pot smoking gains more legitimacy in the nation's most populous state, the governor said he worries it could have negative ripple effects. Quote, the problem with anything, a certain amount is okay, he said. He was speaking, by the way, on NBC's Meet the Press this past Sunday. But there's a tendency to go to extremes, and all of a sudden, if there's advertising and legitimacy, how many people can get stoned and still have a great state or a great nation? End quote. In one of the more candid admissions he made in the conversation with NBC's Meet the Press, he said, quote, we have medical marijuana, which gets very close to what they have in Colorado and Washington. I'd really like those two states to show us how it's going to work. The world's pretty dangerous, very competitive. I think we need to stay alert, if not 24 hours a day, more than some of the potheads might be able to put together, end quote. Now, that sounds like the old Jerry Brown, the Jerry Brown who had two previous terms as governor of the state of California, whose former partner Linda Ronstadt once called him in his second term in the governorship back in the 1970s, Moonbeam, leading the Chicago Sun-Times to refer to the governor as Governor Moonbeam. Jerry Brown was the governor of California from 1975 to 1983. Before coming back as California governor in a spectacular comeback, he retook that office in 2011. He has just recently announced he's going to be running for an unprecedented fourth term beginning in 2015. In between his two different sessions as governor of California, he served as the mayor of Oakland, California, and as California's attorney general. It was in 1978, Rolling Stone wrote the article about him in which Ronstadt called him Moonbeam that led to the Chicago paper calling him Governor Moonbeam. He was known for way-out ideas, and some of those way-out ideas were associated with the drug culture. But that was then, and this is now. And now, the governor says, California won't be good for business if there are too many potheads. It's rather fascinating to hear the governor of the nation's most populous state say that people need to be alert, if not 24 hours a day, then far more than most potheads can muster. What the governor's simply talking about is that he sees marijuana as far more socially significant than many of those who are advocating its legalization. But perhaps the most interesting thing that Governor Brown said about marijuana in his conversation with NBC is where he said, we have medical marijuana, which gets very close to what they have in Colorado and Washington. That is an amazingly candid statement, because medical marijuana is supposed to be about marijuana for documented medical reasons. But as anyone who visits California can quickly determine, especially if you go someplace like Santa Monica near the beach, there are booths set up where if you have a hangnail or a headache or anything else, you will find someone who will give you a prescription, a legal prescription for marijuana, simply because you say you have the need. An ache or a pain here, a syndrome or an impression there, and the next thing you know, you have the prescription. The legalization of marijuana is gaining ground across this country in a very significant moral shift. But it does tell us something, that Jerry Brown, formerly known as Governor Moonbeam, thinks it's a bad idea for his state. Well, if it is, you can count on the fact that it is certainly a bad deal, a bad idea, for your state as well. Finally, shifting the scene to China, it was last Saturday that China experienced what its citizens are now referring to as 301, a reference to 9/11 in the United States. Similarly, this was an instance of Islamic terrorism. In this attack, 29 civilians are dead and more than 130 injured. And as the Wall Street Journal reports, what it amounted to was 40 minutes of apparently premeditated carnage, a panic stampede, hiding in darkness, and the wail of hundreds of terrified people. The attack took place in a province in northwest China, and it has clearly put the Chinese government in a defensive posture, defensive against the threat of Islamic terrorism, which has now risen its head in such a clear way within mainland China, and also defensive against its own people and their fears that this will lead to an outbreak of similar terrorist attacks. But what caught my eye was not so much the news stories coming out of Beijing, but rather a single photograph. The photograph showed hundreds of identically dressed Chinese leaders standing with heads bowed in what was described as a moment of silence commemorating the dead. As the Wall Street Journal reported the event, quote, on Monday, opening an annual meeting of a government advisory body in Beijing, Chinese leaders and hundreds of attendees stood with their heads bowed in a moment of silence for the attack's victims, end quote. Why is that photograph so telling? Well, this is China, and here you had its leaders standing with heads bowed in a moment of silence. But remember that China is an officially communist regime. And not only that, this regime was established by and led by for many years Mao Zedong, the communist leader who announced that one of his purposes was to gain control of the apparatus of government and all the affairs of state in order to break the back of religion so that religion itself would cease to be. But, as it turns out, there are religious impulses even amongst those who are Mao Zedong's heirs, standing in the Great Hall of the People there in Beijing. They were standing at attention with their heads bowed, standing in a position of mourning for those who had died, but also standing with heads bowed in such a way that it implies some kind of religious observance. Someone looking at this from afar would assume that it was a picture of these Chinese leaders at prayer. But, of course, it makes no sense for atheists to pray. And here you have an officially atheistic regime that is trying to pay homage and respect of some sort to the dead, but is doing so simply with a rather empty gesture of standing with eyes closed and heads bowed in a moment of silence. This is a deafening silence. The silence of a people who cannot actually articulate, in terms of any theistic understanding, the reality of what has befallen them, or even the value and dignity of the human lives that were taken by the terrorists. If you take God out of the equation, as the Chinese communists officially do, then the moment of silence is truly, deafeningly silent. There's simply nothing to be said. There's no one to whom to say it. The Chinese communist government claims to be the definer of reality and the ultimate judge of all things in China. In other words, it actually claims more or less to operate as God. And yet, here you had its leaders bowing their head in a moment of silence that was intended to signal respect. But what this photograph I saw truly signaled to me was the deafening silence of a moment of silence when you have Chinese leaders standing with heads bowed and eyes closed to try to say something by that posture of why these human lives were significant. But of course, the defense of human life doesn't come by silence. It comes by argument. And that argument can only be grounded in something greater than the human being. In other words, in the fact that every single human being is created in the image of God. But that's where we began in the briefing today, talking about the issue of abortion with Cecile Richards. And that's where we end on the sanctity of human life with this haunting photograph from Beijing. Thanks for listening to The Briefing. For more information, go to my website at albertmoeller.com. You can follow me on Twitter by going to twitter.com/Albert Moeller. For information on the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary, go to sbts.edu. For information on Boyce College, just go to boycecollege.com. I'm speaking to you from Los Angeles, California. Tomorrow at 10 o'clock and 11 o'clock, I'll be speaking in chapel services at California Baptist University in Riverside. Tomorrow night, I'll be speaking at the Shepherd's Conference at Grace Community Church in Sun Valley here in Los Angeles. On Friday morning, I'll be speaking at the chapel service at the Master's College. Perhaps I'll have the opportunity to see some of you there. I'll meet you again tomorrow for The Briefing.